Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. Now, this is Scott Keith. You're probably missing the voice of Caleb Keith this week. He's feeling under the weather, so we decided to replace him with another Caleb. Caleb Cargis, Dr. Caleb Cargis, will be joining us today. Caleb, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Just give us a brief introduction, and then we'll talk about the topic of the show today. I could say how when I first met you, it was mowing lawns on a riding tractor mower at the back of Bethlehem Lutheran School for your dad, who was the principal at the church where my kids went.
Yeah, I think when Scott and I first met, I was in high school.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Northern Nevada back in the early 2000s. One of my summer jobs was to mow the lawn at the church school. So if you haven't guessed, I grew up in Northern Nevada.
And, Carson City, Dayton, right?
Yeah, Dayton, outside of Carson City. So I usually when people don't know, I tell them I live close to Reno or Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, I say Lake Tahoe.
Lake Tahoe is so pretty. I'm like, I just lived out in the...
I just always call it the Lake Tahoe area. Yeah. It kind of solves the conundrum for people.
Yeah, I found out when I came down here to do my bachelor's degree at Concordia, I'd tell people I was from Carson, and I didn't know there was a Carson, California.
Oh, down in L.A., yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're like, oh, you're from Carson, California. Mm-hmm. Where's that?
No.
There's only one Carson in my mind. It has 60,000 people and one Walmart, now two. But after I did my BA in history at Concordia Irvine, and then I moved on to do my master's and doctorate at the University of St. Andrews, I specialized in Austrian and British military history.
Wow. How'd you get into that? I mean, what was the sort of impetus for you wanting to do military history
work? I was always fascinated by it as a kid. I mean, I always played with toy soldiers. And my dad had he actually had a helmet liner from World War II, and I'd just put that on and go out into our backyard and dig foxholes and just sit in it with a toy gun. And so I carried that on. It's always been a passion. But how I got into that specific topic, I looked at my supervisor who does French military history under Louis XIV, and he asked me, so what languages do you speak? And I looked at him and I said, English and kind of German. And he said, no French, that's a shame. And I was like, well, he thought for a second. He was like, Great Britain and Austria. Nobody's done anything on that. Do that one. And that's how I ended up there. I wanted to work on Napoleon, and then I found out everybody's done stuff on Napoleon, so he rolled me back 100 years. Yeah. And that's how I ended up in that subject.
That's kind of how it works sometimes, right? Yeah. Don't have a great idea going in. You just know you love a particular field, and somebody helps get you to the pointy end of the stick over time, and all of a sudden you're writing 300 pages on something you couldn't have imagined writing 300 pages on.
Yeah, when I first met with my supervisor, he said, oh, you should do your doctorate on the War of the Spanish Succession. I said, sure. And then I went home 30 minutes
what's
later.
That?
Yeah, and looked it up on Wikipedia because I had no idea what it was.
That's great.
That's like Scott and Melanchthon.
Yeah, pretty much.
Who's that? I might add that it's interesting in the historical profession that the military historian is a dying breed.
Mm-hmm.
Caleb, though he's your early 30s, is sort of a dinosaur. The military historians are very, very rare because the academy, it's almost like it's gone with the culture where there's this assumption we've gotten past war, and there's nothing to learn from studying war.
Well, maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Actually, that's one of the things I had to write on when I first started was, this has actually been going back since the 60s, this discussion. Yeah. And, there's the old-timey dying breed of military historian which looks at nothing but campaign commanders and let's see how we set up the armies on the field and
rectangles and triangles on a plane and
on maps and so on. And what I do is something they call the new military history, which is incredibly new since it's been around since 1965 or something, where you look at the intersection of armies and societies, strategy, statecraft, finance, all of these other tools are brought in. Yeah. And you don't just look at campaigns and commanders.
So some sociological components, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so we bring on a military historian into the Thinking Fellows podcast, which is sort of expressly theological, and our listeners are now saying, well, what the heck are you guys going to talk about today? So what we wanted to do is we're sort of in this transition time between finishing our apologetics series and starting up the series that we will begin with in a couple weeks, where we will do major figures in the history of Christianity. And in the in-between time, we wanted to bring some people in and just chase down some interests of some of our friends that are local and our friends that are away. That's why we had last episode Johan Hinderly on, and we talked about camp ministry. He was in from Minnesota, so that was kind of fun. And we have Caleb Cargis, is now full-time faculty, right, at Concordia University in Irvine in the History and Political Thought Department.
That's my chair.
Assistant professor, I'm going to guess. Yeah, yep. Congratulations on that. So Dr. Cargis is here, and I thought maybe we'd discuss a little bit. We have some broad ideas that we can touch on, but I think it'd be interesting, especially as we're sort of in this time period in our history where we've been told we've been at war for, you know, since 2001, right, on this war on terror, and we don't really know what that means, all of us, and people have different ideas what it means. And there's certainly Christians out there throughout history who have opposed the idea of a Christian being, a Christian state being at war, or a Christian individual participating in war on behalf of the state. And there's been a line of thought throughout Christian history that's kind of goes along with the just war doctrine in the Christian tradition. I thought maybe Adam and Caleb together could sort of walk us through how this has been dealt with in the history of the Christian church. How do we look at this idea of war and going to war and being a Christian in a state that's at war, and what are your responsibilities? Should you serve as a soldier? Is it just to serve as a soldier? Is it just for the state to, one state to declare war on another one? So where do we go with that, guys?
Well, there's lots of places. I kind of think, you know, theologically, this is a two kingdoms issue to start with.
Sure.
I mean, I assume our listeners are pretty familiar with that.
Yeah, we had an episode on it some time ago now. But
yeah, I mean, we can hit it again. So that's the idea that God sort of works with his people through two kingdoms, right? And the right-hand kingdom is the kingdom of the gospel. Specifically, that's where the word is preached and the sacraments are administered. And in an interesting way, the left-hand kingdom is sort of everything else. Administration, the state, your Christian vocation in your everyday life apart from the proclamation of the gospel. And so when you say it's a two kingdoms issue, you mean that what we're talking about is Christians living in the realm of the left-hand kingdom, and as Christians intersecting these ideas like, okay, my state is now going to war. What's my responsibility as a Christian, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think sometimes when you get Christians getting weird ideas, it's oftentimes conflating the two kingdoms.
Absolutely.
That's probably the root of some of the weirder Christian views on this.
Yeah. So what are some of the weirder Christian views?
For one, talking about Anabaptists and absolute pacifism. I mean, the example that comes to me is Sergeant York. In my mind, you know, the idea of a Christian just shouldn't kill. Therefore, should not be serving in the military actively trying to take someone else's life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that definitely comes from, you can find earlier medieval precedents, but that comes from the era of the Reformation with the rise of Anabaptism. And it's not every Anabaptist, but even in the probably the earliest Anabaptist confession, the Schleitheim Confession.
Yep, Settler.
Yeah, there's a clear teaching that Christians are not to be involved in any sort of, if you will, left-hand kingdom service.
Yeah.
Politics, and certainly not war. And in the 16th century, when I think that was 1527, if I'm not mistaken, that's at a pretty interesting time in Europe's history. And you got the Turks coming up into the plains of Hungary, with every intention to absorb or annex Christian Europe into the Ottoman Empire, and you know, cause it to be dominated by Islam, Islamic law, and everything else. And here you got Anabaptists who are living in the East, especially in these early days in the Reformation, who are saying things like, let the Turk come in. We might even be better off living underneath the Turk. And in the Reformation context, those our listeners who are familiar with the life of Luther, 1527 and thereabouts, Luther's starting to write in Melanchthon the Visitation Articles, where after they had sort of taken a survey of all the churches that are, though they didn't use the term yet, Lutheran, and they noticed that the level of learning is at an all-time low. It's appalling. Luther once called the Christians their swine. And in the Visitation Articles, there's a whole paragraph on how Christians should think about the war with the Turk. And very specifically, the Lutherans differentiated themselves or separated themselves from the Anabaptist opinion of pacifism. And I don't remember exactly where it is, but at one point Luther calls pacifism simply immoral.
Interesting.
Because you're not, real pacifism, pure pacifism says you're not willing to take up arms to defend the neighbor.
Right.
And so it seems kind of counterintuitive to our culture.
Isn't there an argument that Luther makes at one point where, although it may be immoral, and correct me if I'm wrong, immoral to take up arms to protect yourself, that's a whole other story when you bring your neighbor
in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says in a couple places, whether soldiers too can be saved.
Yeah, whether a soldier too can be saved.
Yeah, and then on War Against the Turk and a few other works, he says... we don't care, or what does it matter if I die?
Yeah, that's more.
We're concerned about our neighbor, right. And because our neighbor is ever present, we're obligated to pick up arms if there's an aggressor. And he would be very much not just caution, but absolutely oppose starting wars for extending state policy or something like that. But if it's a war that's defensive in nature for Luther, and this is, I think. Caleb, you can chime in if you want. For the great classic Christian tradition, this is the position that war is certainly it's of last resort per the doctrine of just war.
Yeah.
But if you have an aggressor, for example, with the push of Islam into the Eastern Mediterranean, Northern Africa in the 7th and 8th century, or the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. As Luther put it, it's a good and divine thing to wage war against them, to strike and slay the enemy and kill every as many of them as you can. Because they're the ones who started it. And the way to end it quickly, to minimize the death toll, is to kill them.
Yeah. Right.
And that's the realization Sergeant York came to when he was in the trenches fighting the Germans and... He didn't want to shoot anyone, and then his unit gets pinned down by machine gun fire, and he realizes if he doesn't start shooting Germans, everybody in his unit is going to die. And what he actually manages to do by picking off a couple Germans causes a whole German regiment or company to surrender and saves essentially a whole lot of their lives and the lives of his unit by doing so. So there's an example on the tactical level, and then what Adam's given here is that kind of the grand strategic.
Mm-hmm. There's a movie out now, not connected with Christianity, but with a pacifist at the center.
Yes. Yeah. I was trying to think of the name of that movie, and I don't have my computer.
Hacksaw Ridge.
Uh-huh. What is
it? I've been meaning to see it. I confess I haven't, but my brothers say it's fantastic.
Stars Spider-Man, so it's got to be okay. So let's come back around to this idea of... just war doctrine in the Christian tradition. What is it, and who were sort of the key figures in that, and what did they have to say? Maybe just even a smattering of their thought on that. So what is just war doctrine in the Christian tradition?
Well, one of the first things I thought about is Adam was mentioning some of the stuff Luther was saying. How much of Luther had Luther read Cicero? There's certain things in that just remind me of things Cicero says and on obligations, a lot of it along the same lines.
Yeah, so Luther certainly was aware of Cicero and probably read him, but a lot of what he got, the reason why he sounds so much like Cicero is because he's taking it from other medieval authors who are just, Cicero is a big authority in the Middle Ages and certainly the Renaissance.
Well, Melanchthon's steep in Cicero.
Yeah. So it's...
And so is Calvin.
Yeah, it's part and parcel of the whole culture of the Renaissance and the Reformation. So Cicero is would you say he probably the earliest formulator? He's first century BC, dies within a year of Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
In the Christian tradition, not the earliest, but probably the one who exposited it to a large extent would be St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to follow the Ciceronian line. And you got St. Thomas Aquinas.
So what is the Ciceronian line there that Augustine follows?
From what I can gather, it's a defensive war is a just war. You know, you're fighting a war to save your neighbor,
yeah,
to protect him.
Yeah, war is always the last resort.
Mm-hmm. Interesting thing for Cicero to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, coming from a Roman.
Yeah.
Who looked for like...
At the same time, what Julius Caesar is over in what we now call France, sort of just making it part of the Republic, right?
Well, yeah.
Well, that's why Julius Caesar got into trouble, was he was starting illegal wars, and that's why he was called back to Rome to answer for what he had done, and he realized he was going to get the death penalty, so yeah, he had to declare war on Rome.
And the opinion, and I don't know why we're going in Roman history here, but the opinion, the public opinion for this, the opinion of the Senate, especially formed against Julius Caesar, was an opinion shaped by Cicero.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, there's the ideal, and then there's reality always in history.
Yeah, but that's something we're having to deal with war.
Yeah,
ideal and reality.
Yeah, the telos of the just cause in war, one of the primary just causes is that going to war and actually fighting is, first of all, the last resort, and it's war is prompted by some sort of act of aggression, if you will, you know. And just war theory says that a war that can be described as just is one that's defensive in nature, and it doesn't necessarily mean that your borders haven't been invaded. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be you're defending somebody overseas. You know, for example, the First Crusade was in many ways a just war, the first one, in that European Christians are coming to the aid of Christians who are being slaughtered in the Holy Land and up in Syria. Literally, at least the texts that we have, and there's debate over whether they're hyperbole or not, but you got accounts of Christian, they didn't circumcise males at that time, at least in the East, nor did they in the West, but you got Christians who, adult males who are being circumcised by Seljuk Turks who have just become Muslims. The blood is being used to put in, or is being put in baptismal fonts. Children are being ripped from the wombs of their mothers. There's one account, our listeners are probably getting sick, but where it describes their favorite form of torturing Christians was cutting around the viscera, the belly button, pulling it out, tying it to a stick, nailing the stick to the ground and whipping them so that as the Christians are running away, their innards are basically just piling out.
Goodness.
So in the First Crusade, the Pope, Urban II, gets word of this. Whether this is really happening or not is a big question, but the sources that we have, the best ones that we have, say it was. And the Pope gets word, and what's he supposed to do under the doctrine of just war? Now, it's the Middle Ages where there is no real serious, certainly no separation. The distinction between church and state is oftentimes blurred, but
at least
something like that, even though it's very far afield, it's across the Mediterranean, that still is defensive in nature, so it falls under the requirements or the justification of war.
Yeah, essentially, even for a Christian it'd people. Be a medieval humanitarian intervention, as mm-hmm. far as the Christians would have seen that
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not that stuff was actually happening, they can't fact check this. This is what they believe is happening. They got to do something about it. I mean, Cicero would also probably point out that you have an obligation towards your allies. So you're not being attacked, but your allies are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have an obligation to serve them.
Yeah, so just war is not, would you say, it's not just, oh, your borders have been, you've been invaded,
right.
So you have to respond. It by defensive, it's pretty far-reaching.
Yeah, you can spread that out.
It's pretty thin.
Yeah. And then when you start kind of splitting hairs, that's when it can get interesting. Well, at what point is it defensive? Are your interests are at risk?
Yeah.
That's a reason people will use for going mm-hmm. to war. I mean,
oil, right?
Yeah, oil.
Yeah, something.
Economics. Like some people say in the Spanish Succession, England went to the war specifically to get the trade rights for trading slaves to the New World. Some will say that was their only reason.
Mm-hmm.
Well, otherwise they had no reason to be in it. They had plenty of reasons, but at the end of the day, their borders weren't being invaded by the French.
So if you flip this around and you say, okay, so there are those Christian traditions who've historically opposed the Christian participating in the war or the Christian state, you know, starting a war, even if it's defensive, what is their argument? And what's their approach to this? What's the flip side of this coin?
Boy, do you want to take that?
Well, I would assume the first place you'd start is the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder.
Yeah, and they'll assume taking the life for a life for any reason is murder.
Yeah,
right?
And then you'd probably want to view the Christian as being outside. You got to kind of have this doctrine of the Christian being separate from the world to such an extent that the Christian cannot function and participate within government, within society. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a monastic kind of way of looking at the earth.
A new monasticism in the really modern period.
Yeah. So really a confusion of two kingdoms, right?
Yeah.
Or no idea of two kingdoms whatsoever.
Yeah, confusion of two kingdoms and possibly conflation of the old Israeli laws, the Old Testament laws, and not understanding how, you know, biblical interpretation works. And
yeah. And the, you know, the Anabaptists in the 16th century, of course, would use, I think, you know, the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself, right? And they'll kind of abstract from the biblical text and just use these proof texts to support their pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing with Anabaptism, is it's, while it's a theological position, it's a theological position that's developed kind of in a vacuum without any sort of input from the historic church, you know. And they'll take, they lift passages of scripture, ignoring the overall context, and use especially passages that have to do with morality and sanctification.
Well, they also have this sort of thread of direct revelation running through through their tradition too, where an individual leader can receive a direct revelation from God, and it can color the particular movement of Anabaptist flair.
Yeah, because of the title, we think Baptist, but it's closer to think Pentecostal.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other route you could go is you could actually go kind of the Puritan route, where it's really, you could only serve a state if they're a pure Christian state, in a sense. There's no reason to serve in the army of a pagan Caesar, but a purely Orthodox Constantine, that's suddenly okay.
Right, which is where some of the Anabaptist groups went as well, right? Yeah. They were plenty willing to fight, as long as they were fighting for this sort of, in the one case of Munster, like we were talking about before, this overtaken city, right, that had now become a theocratic government ruled by their Christian leader for God, and thus they're willing to take up arms for that, but not for their civil prince.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in the early modern period, you'll see kind of Lutheran and Anglican soldiers much more okay with serving under Catholic monarchs than you do, say, some of the hardline Calvinist ones. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you only find hardline Calvinist soldiers serving under other Protestant princes.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And the great example would be the Commonwealth in England, 1649 to 1660, with the rise of Oliver Cromwell, Lord Protector of England, and his son who quits, Richard, where the Puritans are more than willing to take up arms for that cause.
Mm-hmm.
But under James I or Charles I or Charles II and James II.
And a lot of those guys had actually been serving under Gustavus Adolphus in Germany. Mm. They're willing to fight for Protestantism there.
Yeah, in the Thirty Years' War.
And then they came over to England ready to fight.
All right. Well, I think that's going to be take our time for our advertising break, and we'll see you after or hear you after the break. Welcome back. This is our break. Today, I wanted to talk to you about conference that we've been talking about several times before. This is our Here We Still Stand conference, which is coming up this October 19 through 21, 2017. We'll be holding this conference to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. We're hosting this conference at a very nice hotel down in San Diego. It's the Hyatt Regency Mission Bay Spa and Marina in San Diego, California. Free room for speakers, Adam.
Nice.
We have all sorts of great speakers coming in. I mean, we have Rod Rosenblatt, Matt Popovitz, Jared Wilson, Lise Fitzpatrick, Dave Zoll, Steve Paulson. I think I'll be there. I think Adam's going to be there. Steve Brown, Dr. John Montgomery, Chad Bird, Chris Roseborough, Dan Van Voorst, Jeff Mallinson, Uwe Simonuto, Donovan Riley, Jessica Thompson, RJ Grunewald, and my buddy Eric Sorensen. All will be there. Right now is a great time to sign up. If you haven't signed up yet, you kind of missed the cheapest price, but we're now just in the second category. You can get the entire conference. Ticket price will include all the main sessions, all the breakouts, all your choice of dessert buffet on Thursday night, breakfast, lunch, and dinner on Friday, and even breakfast on Saturday, all for $149 if you register now. I mean, it's an amazing price. It's obviously heavily offset by donations, and in particular, a couple of very generous donors who are helping us to put this thing on. I want you to go check it out. It's over at herewestillstand.org, herewestillstand.org. You can also check it out just by going to 1517legacy.com. It's on our front page. It's the Here We Still Stand Reformation Conference, a Reformation celebration. It's October 19th through 21, 2017, Hyatt Regency Mission Bay in San Diego, California. Check it out at herewestillstand.org. Thanks. All right, we're back. So that was an interesting conversation. Didn't quite go the direction that I thought we might go with it, but I like it better when we do that. And the whole time you guys were sort of going through just war and sort of Christian tradition and this idea of defensive war and how that can kind of be smooched around by Christians throughout the ages to mean various things, right? It doesn't necessarily just mean what I would think it would mean, that somebody's attacking my borders and they're thus I go defend my borders, a defensive war. You said it's sort of been morphed into defending my interest, defending my neighbors, defending my allies, defending my friends, that type, even if they're not bordering me or near to me. And I was sitting here thinking about the idea of this war on terror that we've been fighting probably longer than since 2001. But certainly since 2001, so now 16 years at least, a war on terror. And I know there have been many, many attempts to sort of categorize this in the area of just war. But how should Christians view the war on terror in this way? I mean, it's not necessarily like officially declared in a lot of ways, right? It's not one state against another state oftentimes. Certainly, I think it could be seen to be defensive in a way. We were attacked. We are attacked. Our interests are attacked. Our neighbors are attacked. Our allies are attacked. Even our citizens, sometimes when they're especially abroad, are attacked, and even here at home are attacked. I mean, but how does this fit into that category, or does it, or is it something altogether different?
Well, if I could put one thing into the minds of those back in that city of psychopaths we call D.C., it would be, have you considered that Islam is not a religion in the same sense that Confucianism, Buddhism, Judaism, and others are? Have you thought about that? And as near as I can figure out, nobody has. Because I think unless we do that, we will be confused by our own categories, constitutional categories, about freedom of religion. I want somebody back there to ask, in what sense is this a religion? And I'd like to contend with them. It's first of all political, social, conquering, and then the veneer is Allah. But I'm alone with that one.
People are starting to actually think that way. There was a chaplain, I don't know if I can name him, so I won't,
no.
But who wrote a paper I think it was a master's thesis for the Army War College, arguing just that. In the war on terror, religion, what we call religion, needs to be a factor in our study of it. And behind it all is this premise that the enemy that we're dealing with uses religion to justify political and other sorts of activity.
Yeah, talk about there not being two kingdoms. This is one kingdom with a vengeance.
Yeah, and also because, and the reason why they use religion to justify these things, because it actually isn't a religion anyway. It's a ideology. It's a politic or whatever you want to call it. So
it's an all-encompassing system.
Yeah.
There is no distinction between kingdoms. There's one encompassing everything.
Yeah. And, I mean, further complicating matters with regard to the war on terror is the actors in the war. On the other side, they're not part of, at least in a way that is available or that we can verify publicly. Now, behind the scenes, who knows what's going on, but they're what we call non-state actors, right? So, Scott, you referred to this thing we call in the war on terror. Breaks all our categories, because it's not the U.S. versus Saudi Arabia or whatever. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with a...
Yeah, there's an inability to communicate through official channels.
Yeah, we're fighting people who latch onto an ideology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're fighting an ideology. And so the rules for just war, I mean, they were created in... not in the modern nation-state system, but essentially created in a world where you've got these distinct...
Sure.
States, empires, state, and call them what you want. But now, these are individual actors, or a dozen of them acting out of some mud hut somewhere.
Yeah.
And
the other thing is, I'd like to get some of the bright ones together and say, or ask, evidently you think that we have an ideology that is self-referentially superior. I take it everybody in the room... talking about civilization in the West, I want to ask you why you think it's superior to what is coming from the Middle East. Or have you even thought about it? Have you even thought about it? Do you have any kind of ideology other than general mushy evolutionary social progress? And if you think that'll stand up against an ideology that really is distinct and persuaded, you're naive.
Mm-hmm.
So does it change my question, though? I mean, the Christian who's sort of considering maybe serving in the military, you know, mm-hmm. and knows that if they make the decision to, yes, serve in the military, the current military, that at some point in their life, most likely they will participate in this war on terror, you know, somewhere
in some capacity,
somewhere in the Middle East or elsewhere. And, you know, they're not necessarily a pacifist, but they're trying to sort of justify what their role would be on this. Can they go to just war theory on it? And is that helpful still?
I think yes.
Okay.
I hope so.
I'm thinking about this historically in terms of dealing with Islam. There has always, going back to the Byzantines, dealing with non-state actors, in a sense. Like, you could be at peace with the caliph, but guess what? Your borders are constantly at war with random Ghazis bringing their raiding parties across the borders and, you know, raping and pillaging their way, taking slaves, taking money, and so on. I mean, it goes back to the Byzantines. They're at peace, but they're at war. And then later on, when we move on to the Habsburg-Turkish Wars, it's the same thing. The Habsburgs have to actually set up a military border in Croatia, in Hungary, where there is an entire class of people called Grenzers, German for borderers, who are given land and free rights to essentially be at constant war with constant Serbian, Bosnian, Turkish raiders coming from the other side. And what I see going on here is now, you know, if you want to talk about globalization and all that, is you're dealing with a globalized version of this. Instead of nice, clean borders,
mm-hmm.
now you're dealing with people being able to travel at will, through plains and so on.
Porous borders.
Yeah, very porous borders in a very weird way. It's no longer a land border. Like, the porous border could be Denver International Airport, for goodness sake. Like, you know, right in the middle of the place. So dealing with that, suddenly now you could actually conceive of having to fight a defensive war halfway around the world when, say, in 1648, that was a...
An odd thought.
Yeah, that was incredibly odd.
Yeah, but
in the case of dealing with Islam, there has always been this case. I mean, Adam could probably tell you about Samuel Huntington's thesis about bloody borders.
Mm-hmm.
But historically speaking, this has always been there.
Yeah.
I will argue for it. The only case where you probably get that being contained is when the Ottoman Empire decides to act more like a European nation state. And they kind of put a clamp on this stuff in the 19th century.
Two things that are coming up. One, we have to get back to your question about the Christian, maybe the 18-year-old out there who's in high school or first year of college, and they're finding that college isn't fulfilling because they're learning how to make things out of Play-Doh or something, you know, whatever they do.
Yeah, whatever is trivial.
And maybe they're thinking there's something better. And in fact, you and Scott, you and I read a book by Rourke Denver,
right,
who was, I forget what SEAL team he was on, but now he's I think he's still reserves, but he's out of active duty and he's on the sort of speaking.
SEAL training for, I think, 6 years too.
Yeah. But I forget the title of the book, but he says in there.
I think it's Willing to Die For or something
like that. Yeah.
I'll look it up real quick.
But either in that book or in an interview I heard him, or in which I heard him, he says something like, if you really want to learn how to love your neighbor, join the military.
Yeah, that's an interesting. That was in that, that was in the Art of Manliness podcast interview.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then if you really want to serve, join the military.
Yeah.
And that was pretty interesting. And along those lines, with regard to the question, can a Christian serve? If you want a historic text to read, it's the one we referred to earlier, Whether Soldiers Too Can Be Saved by Luther. That's 1523 or 26.
Yep.
Where people actually were asking Luther, these Christians who are hearing the voice of the Anabaptists, who say you can't serve in the left-hand
civil
realm.
No Christian can.
And they're saying, what are we to do? How should we think about this? And Luther gives this remarkable, I don't know how long it was. It's not lengthy, but it's not super short, but just a comprehensive response to that question.
Yeah.
The title is Whether Soldiers Too Can Be Saved. It's actually kind of misleading. It's, you know, is it proper for a Christian to serve in the military or any other sort of political type of vocation? And his answer is a resounding yes. And I'll give you a link, Scott, to a tiny one-page article I wrote on that question for a Lutheran witness. But his answer is Christians obviously or absolutely can serve. And in fact, in serving, they're serving or they're acting as a mask of God. You know, it's a legitimate vocation, and it's through vocation, whatever it is, whether it's pastor on one hand or garbage.
Yeah, bootmaker.
Bootmaker or what do you call it, sanitation engineer or whatever.
Yep.
That's how God keeps the world orderly, right? In, you know, sort of his left-hand kingdom reign.
Yeah.
And the military vocation is an outstanding example of that.
Yeah.
There are other, obviously there are tons of other vocations, but if it's a choice between serving in the military and maybe getting involved in the entertainment industry.
Sure.
Probably the more virtuous one, not that we're interested you know, in getting into these sort of judgments of what's virtuous or not, but probably a military vocation by far is superior to being involved in that horrendous pile of poo-poo.
I'll get excited now because we're speaking theologically a little bit. So I think one of the most interesting misconceptions within our current Christian age is this idea that in order to serve God, you actually, it's sort of new monasticism in a sense. You actually have to give up all that is around you.
Travel around the world.
Your current life. Your current comfort.
Be deprived.
Be deprived. Be deprived on the backs of other people's wealth.
Yeah.
Because they're going to ask you for money. You know, this is when somebody who's all of a sudden, you know, is going around the world on a mission trip that you haven't heard from in 5 years, you get a phone call. And at the end of the day, you know why you got the phone call, right? Because in order for them to deprive themselves of all their worldly comforts, they need to raise $30,000 to go around the world.
Yeah.
And that idea is kind of ridiculous scripturally. I mean, scripturally, the fact is that God works through everyday messy stuff, right? Yeah. And it's the everyday that's sort of the linchpin there. And mm-hmm. everyday messy stuff, everyday messy people. And it's how
he, and without the Reformation, you don't have that.
Yeah, without right. the Reformation theology, you don't have that. But it's how he, when we say, how does God, you know, when even when a non-believer can say, well, how does God actually help me? What does he actually do for me?
Mm-hmm.
The Christian can boldly answer, he helps you every day through the service of your neighbor, mm-hmm. right? That's how he sort of keeps this whole project going and,
yeah, but,
and prevents it from spinning out of control.
Sure, and something that you haven't even thought of, he actually died in Christ that you aren't going to face judgment.
Well, okay, yeah. Thank you for taking us to that.
Yeah, and, yeah. Then, yeah. and then to the left kingdom.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of, it's interesting to me when we sort of think that we can abstract our service to God outside of the everyday muck of our normal lives.
Yep.
Right? The whole idea of how does one serve their neighbor or how does one serve God? Well, he doesn't really need you to serve him.
Yep, but your neighbor does.
Your neighbor does,
yeah. yep.
and in so doing, on account of Christ and because of Christ,
yep.
in so doing, you're serving him.
Yep.
Unbeknownst to you, probably,
yep.
even. And mm-hmm. even in something like the military. And that book is Work Denver, Worth Dying For,
mm-hmm.
A Navy SEAL's Call to a Nation. And that was the best part of the book, to be honest with you, and the interview, is when he started talking about the absolute service to your neighbor when you're in the trenches, mm-hmm. that guy right next to you,
yep,
and that when those guys are there, really that's what they're thinking about,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
They're maybe not even as they're thinking about their objective, but even more than the objective is serving the guys that are next to them.
Absolutely.
And you probably will never get a clearer sense of Christian service to neighbor, mm-hmm. than if you've lived that, and not to like... I haven't lived it, so I've only actually seen it through the production of the entertainment industry. So, and you know, sort of had a glimpse of it there. But yeah, and it kind of takes us back. We were having a discussion before we came back from the break, or Rod said that he, you know, his 30 years at Concordia University, what he encountered very frequently was sort of an unthinking pacifism,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a lot of that.
Yeah, unless there's some sort of resurgence of the historic Christian faith, and I would say the Reformation is your best guide to it, but unless there's some sort of ideology that can stand against an ideology like Islam, how are you going to do that from secularism?
Mm-hmm.
Real patriotism? I don't think so. You know,
mm-hmm.
Somebody back there has got to be thinking, do we have an ideology that can stand up against a fake religion that really is world-conquering, or don't we?
I'm actually beginning to see communities on the internet popping up that are actually calling back to historic Christianity as the answer to
Good.
The problem.
Yeah, that's right.
Good on them.
Yeah.
You know, they're Catholics, they're Orthodox, they're
okay.
Reformational, they're all looking at the current problems and saying secularization is not the answer. We need to go back.
That's progress.
Yeah, some of them you may not like. Some of them are, we need to go back to medieval Christendom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They make all kinds of calls to a crusade.
Probably get some crusade. Some Lutherans.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as you go back before Luther, everybody knows that during the reign of the Roman Church, there was no distinction either.
Mm-hmm.
Not really. The state was like this, I'm making a small gesture, and the church over it was really everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's not two kingdoms, not really.
Right.
The Reformation has more answers than some people have even yeah. delved into, and it is worth it.
Yeah.
Well, and sort of theologically, the idea, I think, behind pacifism is a low view of sin.
Right? Of course.
It's this idea that, well, sin isn't really as big a problem as maybe those guys over there are making it out to be.
Yep.
Evil's really not a thing as much as somebody's not educated enough,
yep.
they're not trained enough, they yep. don't know enough. If we could just get over there and we could treat them well, we could treat them justly for once in their lives, and we could educate them for once in their
help.
Lives, we wouldn't have a problem. And, I mean, you two, you Adam and Caleb could probably tell us historically how that's turned out.
Oh, bad.
Yeah.
You know, once you do that, it's mostly genocide.
Yeah.
A lot of this idea tends to come out of the 18th century Enlightenment kind of sure. thought, where you're starting to see people rejecting the doctrine of original sin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the time when you're seeing people beginning to come up with these kind of a weird utopian projects.
Yep.
How we can actually, the Enlightenment thinkers are actually looking at the world, and fair enough, the world is getting better in Europe at this time. And they're going, we may be able to reach a level.
Yep.
Where we may never have to have war again.
Yep.
And then they implement the French Revolution. They declare peace to the whole world. 3 years later, they've declared war on every single country in Europe.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's a paradigm case.
What else are you going to do?
It's a paradigm case. Yeah.
This kind of makes me think of in something you said earlier, Scott, or Caleb, you mentioned Samuel Huntington.
Yeah.
And after the Cold War, there was a really interesting thing that happened in amongst political scientists. Everybody's scrambling in the early 1990s to write that article that's going to inform policymakers on how they should think about the future, to give them kind of a paradigm on yep. what's the future look like now that it's no longer the free world versus the totalitarian world, or the first world versus the second world, or however you want to put it. And this guy, a student of Samuel Huntington, his name was Francis Fukuyama, who's still around today, and he's rejected the thesis he puts forward. But he wrote an article in, I think it was in Foreign Affairs, or one of the major journals that people at the State Department, CIA, and other places would read, called The End of History. And it became a book called The End of History and the Last Man. And this is making it very basic, but he argues that if history is kind of a record of competition and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way historians usually kind of mark things anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Says it might be now that that communism is over in the Soviet Union, and it looks like other communist bloc countries are opening up to democratic institutions like China and the East. It looks like that democracy is going to win, and like the guy at the New York Times, a Friedman, put it, no two nations that have a McDonald's in them, I guess a McDonald's is a symbol of democracy, have never been at war with each other. Fukuyama says, we might reach the end of history, not in an apocalyptic way, but in terms of there being competition and that boils over into conflict. And so he publishes this like 1993, 94 or thereabouts, and who doesn't love it? You know, it's a brave new world ahead of us,
sure,
right?
Sure.
His teacher, Samuel Huntington at Harvard University, recently deceased, wrote a kind of response to that entitled The Clash of Civilizations, and then when it became a book, he added to it, and the remaking of the world order. And he says, don't think conflict's coming to an end. Even though the Cold War is over, the old pattern of conflict between nation states is going to reemerge, only this time the flashpoint will be over ideology.
Uh-huh.
And he says there's about a dozen, give or take a few, distinct civilizations that have as their root identity strong presuppositions about the way the world is and how things relate to each other. You've got like Cynic or Confucian civilization in China. You've got Orthodox civilization in Russia and Eastern Europe. You've got Islamic civilization in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. You got Hindu civilization. You got Western civilization, and so on and so forth. He says the three big ones: Western civilization, which is a mixture of Christian and Enlightenment ideals.
Yep.
Chinese civilization, they're already competing with each other,
mm-hmm.
and still are. Mm-hmm. And then you've got another major civilization, Islamic civilization. And he says, Caleb hinted at it earlier, watch out for this one, because Islam has always had, and he's quoting Bernard Lewis, who's like sort of the Islamic scholar in the Western world. He's in his 90s now, but still working.
Mm-hmm.
Islam has always had bloody borders. Buried in its ideology is kind of a, I think you refer to it as a global conquest idea.
Yeah.
And while there are lots of Muslims who are completely ignorant of that, and thank goodness for it, that's, you still can't get around it because it's embedded within their particular text.
Yep.
And so where was I going with all this?
I have one reaction from what Caleb said. Be very, very careful of ever buying anything that smacks of utopianism.
That usually ends up in millions of deaths.
Yeah. Yep.
Anytime you...
Well, here's where I was going with this. 1990s, when the State Department is thinking, what's next? Mm-hmm. Who gives the better news? Fukuyama, you know? Mm-hmm. So Clinton, Bush 2, not in that order,
mm-hmm.
They kind of buy into that Fukuyama, it's called neoconservative idea. If we make the world safe for democracy, or we help install democracies around the world, it will alleviate the competition. At best, it will be economic competition, but it will never spill over into military conflict.
Yeah,
is that the,
so
the end
utopian
of history?
As the day is long. That's the end of history.
And the last man. Is that
Yeah, and there's been, ever since the war on terror began, there's been a lot of criticisms of the neoconservative idea. Because
Well, everybody ignored Huntington because I'm using air quotes like Scott likes to do, he's an Islamophobe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he says this nasty thing about Islamic civilization that actually about 5 years after he publishes the book ends up being, in a way, true. Now,
prophetic.
He himself said there's, you know, this is just a theory. We need to work out the details. But it was much more, it corresponded much more to the world than Fukuyama's utopian ideas. Mm-hmm. And who doesn't like to think of a future where my kids are safe on a street running?
It's very seductive to anybody.
Yeah.
But you got to first know I'm easily seduced into utopian schemes.
Yeah.
To begin with,
You
know, that kind of self-knowledge to say, I'm a sucker for this.
Yeah.
And at bottom, we need to have a show on heaven and whatnot because I'm not easily sucked into that kind of thing.
Terrific.
I mean, it drives me crazy when we sort of even portray, you know, the new heaven and the new earth in terms of sort of just like what I think are probably enlightenment utopian ideals more than biblical reality.
Sure.
And I think people are drawn to it because it's been pounded into our head.
Well, we've got a Reformation group that, thank God, small, but are radically post-millennial.
Right.
And they bought into Wilson's sort of League of Nations view of the world, added Christian color to it. And I'm in the back tearing my hair out saying, you're kidding. You're going to actually believe in that kind of progress. It's a reformed utopian scheme again.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. If we could just get it all right.
Yeah.
If we could just dial it in. And I think that, personally, I think that's such a low view of sin. I even think it's sort of a low view of the individuality in a way, in a calling to, you know, serve in an individual capacity that'll never create sort of some messiness in work.
Yeah. It's a kind of Gnosticism as well, I
think.
Eric Voegelin,
I think that's what drives me crazy about it.
And Gnosticism or something where he talks about
there's no meatiness to it. It's just all heady and kind of makes me nuts. Well, this has been a very different episode that we have to wrap up. We went
We didn't give Caleb the mic enough.
The second half.
We'll do another hour.
We went all sorts of directions, and I hope the listeners appreciate it. We tried to do some stuff on just war theory and doctrine and Christian tradition, but I think what we got into was this idea that I like is this idea of pacifism as being a sort of a misrepresentation of a Christian view, right?
Naive. Well meant, but naive.
Well meant, contains a very low view of sin, probably not a biblical view of sin, and that, as Caleb said, typically lends to genocide. So maybe some more to think about. We'll put those books that Adam brought up in the show notes so that the listeners can do some more reading if they'd like to. And again, as always, we thank you for joining us on Thinking Fellows.